From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Your brain can do amazing things. Your thoughts can actually rewire your brain. Music can reach parts of the brain that language can't even touch. And with the right prompting, you can call up memories you didn't even know you had. Today, we'll explore the mysteries of the mind and meet some fascinating people along the way, from neurologist Oliver Sacks to creativity guru Linda Barry. Also, the mind of a creature so different from us, you'd swear it had to be from another planet. But it's not. We'll take you to meet an octopus. Do you sometimes feel overly anxious or stressed out, not able to bounce back after a bad day at the office? If so, you might want to think about training your mind to be more resilient. Neuroscientist Richard Davidson says mindfulness training can help rewire the brain. He's teamed up with the Dalai Lama to put Buddhist monks in his brain scanning machines, and he's developing a new scientific model for studying emotion. But when Davidson was a Harvard grad student back in the 70s, he tells Steve Paulson that hardly anyone thought emotions were worth studying.
I wanted to study emotion because I had this kind of inner conviction that emotion was really the key to so much that was important about human behavior. We inevitably resort to language that includes emotion. A person is friendly, or they're grumpy, or they're cheerful. It just struck me that emotion was key to understanding our personality.
Now, you write about something else that happened back in the 70s when you were living in the Boston area. Some of your circle of friends were involved in meditation, and that somehow seemed to hit home for you.
That was a very important influence, and these are all people who had been to India. When I first met these guys, they struck me as being extraordinarily kind, gentle, humble people, and it was their demeanor that impressed me most, not the content of what they were talking about, but just who they were as people.
So you ended up going off to India and Sri Lanka to study meditation, right, as well as to do it.
I did. I left at the end of my second year of graduate school, much to the consternation of some of the faculty at Harvard, who thought that either I was going off the deep end or B, that I would never return.
What did you do over in Sri Lanka and India?
Well, in Sri Lanka, I was able to meet people who are contemplatives, who've spent their life training their mind and familiarizing themselves with their mind. These were people who were utterly familiar with the operation of their own mind in ways that I think are not common in the West because they've just spent so much time doing it. I then went off to India and had my first taste of intensive meditation practice. And this is kind of like meditation boot camp where we're in retreat in complete silence and meditating for, you know, more than 12 hours a day. It's very difficult to go through an experience like that and not really feel that your mind can be powerfully affected.
So it sounds like what you're saying is that your interest in the science of the mind, the science of mindfulness, has very personal roots.
It does have very personal roots. And, you know, I became involved in psychology and neuroscience because I was convinced that if people can transform their mind, we can actually make the world a better place.
Hmm. But I just want to follow up on this early point because it sounds like a really radical idea that mental activity alone can change the brain, can actually change the physical structure of the brain.
I think at that time it was a radical statement, unquestionably. And the amazing thing is now I think that the majority of neuroscientists would agree with it.
No, I'm willing to bet that people who have read about you in the popular press actually know you best because of your work with the Dalai Lama and with a number of Buddhist monks. And I know this has been important to you personally. Can you take me back to the first time you met the Dalai Lama?
I met him for the first time in the fall of 1992 at his residence in Dharamsala, India. And I was in India as part of a small scientific team that he wished to encourage to investigate the minds and brains of advanced meditation practitioners who were practicing in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. it was a very special moment. I was the spokesperson for this group of four. And when you go in to meet the Dalai Lama, you know, you have to go through certain security. He's considered a head of state. And I'm not a person who I'd consider to be very high anxious. But in the period where just after we were searched, I nearly had a panic attack. And it was because I could not envision how I was going to start the conversation. I just reflected, you know, here I was about to meet His Holiness the Dalai Lama. I was flooded with all of this self-doubt. Why am I here? Who am I to be wasting the Dalai Lama's time? And we were ushered into a room, and the Dalai Lama came in, you know, maybe 15 seconds after we were ushered into the room, and palpably within less than 1 minute, all of my anxiety was completely and utterly and totally gone. And not only was my anxiety gone, but I felt more secure and more content than I had felt in a long, long time.
So what happened in that first minute?
You know, the Dalai Lama has an amazing presence, and he walked in, made some joke, and started laughing, and just instantaneously, he has, I think, an extraordinarily skillful way of seeing suffering in others. And he clearly, I'm sure, saw that I was very uncomfortable. And this was a way that he spontaneously and just with enormous facility completely dissipated.
Now, you've written that that first meeting with the Dalai Lama has had a tremendous impact on your life. It changed your life, both in a career sense and also in a personal sense. What happened? How did things go in a different direction after that?
Well, he at one point in the conversation really challenged me, and he said, you know, you've been using the tools of modern neuroscience to study things like fear and disgust and depression and anxiety. And he said, why can't you study kindness? why can't you study compassion? Huh. And, you know, it was a really pivotal moment.
Had you thought about that before?
Not really. You know, it just was so outside the scientific worldview. Nobody studied kindness and compassion who was a real scientist.
So that, among other things, led you to studying various Buddhist monks. I mean, experienced meditators who'd spent thousands of hours in some cases meditating to actually bring them into your lab, into your MRI machines.
Yes, it directly led to that. And so I made a commitment to His Holiness on that day that I was going to do everything I could to put compassion on the scientific and specifically the neuroscientific map, and that one of the ways that we would do it is to begin to seriously study long-term practitioners.
What's been the most important thing you've learned from those studies?
We haven't even begun to approach the limits of human neuroplasticity. It's been a humbling experience to work with these long-term practitioners to get a glimpse of the depth in which we can actually change our brain and do that through changing our mind, transforming our minds. That has been really an extraordinarily powerful opportunity to learn that.
Neuroscientist Richard Davidson runs the Center for Investigating Healthy Minds at the University of Wisconsin. He talked with Steve Paulson about his book, The Emotional Life of Your Brain. When you hear someone like Richie Davidson talk about the opportunities brought by change, it opens pathways. It's one of the things that makes public radio special, a place that foments change in positive ways for all of us. You can be part of making your public radio station possible with a pledge of financial support right now. Here's someone to tell you how. We're talking this hour about the mysteries of consciousness. Now, you want a real mystery? Try getting inside the mind of an animal. And no creature is more mysterious and amazing than the octopus. Science writer Cy Montgomery discovered this herself.
They're so different from us. They can taste with their skin. They have no bones. They can squeeze through a tiny opening, oozing almost like they are liquid themselves. A 100-pound giant Pacific octopus can get through an opening the size of an orange. I mean, unbelievable. But what I think is even more unbelievable is the fact that these guys have developed intelligence and emotions and personalities that are enough like ours that we can recognize them as such.
So how do you approach an octopus? Because it doesn't seem to have any avenue to communicate.
Well, I had the opportunity to meet three octopuses because very generously the New England Aquarium has given me access to them and will open the top of the tank and let me plunge my arms into the 47-degree water and touch them and let them touch and, interestingly, taste me.
In fact, you've written about the first encounter you had with an octopus we called Athena.
Yes, and we got on absolutely great the first time we met. She looked me in the eye. I plunged my arms into the water. Hers started boiling up out of the water. She immediately attached her suckers to me. Each of her eight arms has about 200 suckers, and each one of those suckers can not just feel exquisitely, but they taste you. So she knows me in a way that no one else has ever known me before.
That has to have been just a little bit odd, wasn't it? I mean, you knew, of course, what you were going into, but...
You know, I wrote that it felt like the kiss of an alien. Did she like me? Well, I guess so. It's hard to imagine what she experienced. But the thing is, if an octopus doesn't like you, you know about it. They show this in several ways, and they're unmistakable. One is they won't come near you. Or it's well known that octopuses who dislike you will aim their funnel at you and shoot water at you. And they have excellent aim with their funnels. There was an octopus named Truman who lived at the New England Aquarium. And he was a pretty easygoing octopus, but there was this one woman that he just could not stand. And she was a nice woman. She worked there all summer, and every time Truman saw her, he aimed his funnel and he blasted her, and she was soaking wet with salt water all the rest of the day. And interestingly, she went away to college and then came back for a visit. Meanwhile, Truman had not soaked anyone. But when he set eyes on her again, blam, he blasted her again. So he remembered her and just didn't like her.
We've talked about their interaction with you. I'm curious, before we come back to that, what you know about their interaction with each other. Do we know much about octopus culture, if you will, octopus society?
They're not that easy to study, but what we know suggests that they're not particularly social and that their interactions tend to be kind of limited to chasing each other away, mating, or eating each other. And that begs the question, what's this intelligence that they have for? Because when we look at intelligent species who we know, animals like elephants or chimpanzees or whales, they are long-lived, highly social species, as are we. But here is an animal who doesn't live very long. Alas, the giant Pacific will only live about 3 years. And they don't appear to be very social with other octopuses. So what do they do with their intelligence? Interestingly, they play. And play is one of those things that we tend to associate with higher thought, right? At the New England Aquarium, my friend Wilson Menashe designed a series of locking boxes, which are plexiglass, and the octopus enjoys unlocking the different locks to get to a crab inside.
What about their brains? Is there a similarity between their brains and ours?
The difference in their brains is what excites me. I mean, their brain's probably about the size of a walnut, which is as big as an African gray parrot's. And you might think, oh, bird brain. But I've known an African gray parrot who could speak 100 words meaningfully as well as do math. So size doesn't really matter. But what strikes me so much about the octopus brain is that 3/5 of their neurons are not in the brain at all. They're in the arms. Dr. Godfrey Smith, a professor of philosophy in New York, has said it's as if each arm has a mind of its own. And octopuses can regrow their arms if through some accident an arm becomes severed. That arm will go off and search for prey on its own and find it. And then start passing the prey item back toward where the mouth ought to be, but no longer is anymore, in the center of the eight arms. I mean, can you imagine that kind of diffuse consciousness? I mean, maybe it's like multiple personality. If consciousness means the self and your neurons are more in your arms than in your head, does that mean you have multiple selves? What does that mean? But this is their reality. And animals are constantly leading us to recognize other realities that are just as real as ours. Birds and insects can see polarized light. Animals like whales and elephants can hear infrasound, which we cannot. But we know it is real. It is a real part of our world.
Cy Montgomery wrote about the mind of the octopus in Orion magazine.
He's a friend to you and me.
I'd ask my friends to come and see an octopus's garden with me.
Love you. Octopus, I love you.
I loved listening to Cy Montgomery talk about her three octopuses. I keep thinking about the differences I expected from humans, but found my thinking changed by her descriptions of the similarities. Now, that is when you know you've heard good radio. And that applies to almost everything in our series of interviews on consciousness. That's why you enjoy your public radio station. We hope you will go from being that to being one of the people who not only enjoy but support your station. Here's someone to tell you how. Neurologist Oliver Sacks is famous for his stories of people with brain disorders, from Parkinson's disease to autism. In books like Awakenings and The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, he explores neurological mysteries. For instance, how powerfully some of us respond to music. How is it that a song can activate parts of the brain that language can't even touch? In his book, Musicophilia, Sacks writes about people who were transformed by music. He tells Steve Paulson about one of his patients.
Tony was a surgeon in his early 40s, very robust and athletic and extroverted, with very little interest in music. And one day, this was in 1993, he was on the phone. It was an outside phone. A storm approached. A bolt of lightning flew out from the phone, hit him in the face, gave him a cardiac arrest, and along with this, an out-of-body experience. He was resuscitated, and he seemed pretty much himself, except 2 or 3 weeks later, he got what he called a sudden, insatiable passion to hear piano music, and then to play piano music, and then to compose music. And in the course of about 48 hours, he really became transformed. He became possessed by music. That was his term. He started getting up at 3 a.m. and he got a piano. He got a piano teacher. He learned to transcribe. He was at music when he came back from his surgery. He said his wife wasn't best pleased. And basically, this has continued.
And there was nothing in his background that would suggest this love of piano music.
Really, very little, either on the musical side or, for that matter, on what he likes to call the spiritual side, because he now feels that this was a providential event, a sort of a divine intervention, and that, in a sense, the music comes from heaven and he has a mission to bring it to earth. And so there was also a certain change in character and a sort of a mystical element crept in.
You write about other cases where music is profoundly therapeutic. For instance, you have worked with people with Parkinson's and Alzheimer's diseases, and these people may not be able to talk easily. They may not even be able to move very well, but often those problems seem to disappear when they listen to music or play music.
Yeah, well, this is where things started for me as a physician, and more than 40 years ago when I saw the patients whom I later described in Awakenings, and these people were almost transfixed with extremely severe Parkinsonism, catatonia, but music could liberate them in the most remarkable way, and they could dance, they could sing, they could move normally, they could think normally while the music lasted. music can just have an amazing effect in recalling deeply demented people to life, and music has its special uses in aphasia and people who've lost language, because even though they may not be able to speak, they're usually able to sing and often to recover the lyrics of a song.
Well, that's fascinating. So you're suggesting then that the part of our brain that deals with language is a different part than deals with singing, for instance.
Oh yeah, absolutely. This was really discovered, you know, right back in the 1860s when it was found that aphasic children could sing. And even though there might be damage in the left hemisphere of the brain causing the loss of language, singing seemed to be associated with the right hemisphere of the brain. Although in general, there's no music center in the brain. There's 20 or 30 different systems or networks in the brain involved in listening to music or imagining music or reacting to music. And I think this is why music is so robust. And even when speech may be lost, you know, other parts of the brain are still there.
Well, you say something astonishing in your book, that neuroscientists can actually spot a professional musician just by looking at the image of their brain.
Oh, yeah, I was very fascinated by this. And I wouldn't have believed it had I not sort of seen this myself. This is beautiful work, especially done by a man called Gottfried Schlaug. And he found that in many different areas, in the corpus callosum, this great bridge between the two hemispheres, in the auditory parts of the brain and in the motor parts of the brain and in the visuospatial parts of the brain, there was a real enlargement of gray matter in musicians' brains. And this is sometimes visible to the naked eye, so that although you can't look at a brain and say, that's the brain of a mathematician or a visual artist, you can look at a brain and say, this is probably the brain of a musician.
So do you think this different brain anatomy is something that is changed as people hone their talent for music, or is it something that some people are just born with?
I'm sure both. And sometimes it's difficult to tease out, because people who are naturally very gifted are likely to have, you know, intensive early musical training. But there have been studies with people who've had, say, a year of intensive violin training, the Suzuki method, looking at their brains before and after a year. And you can see very clearly the changes which have occurred.
You write about another remarkable case study, the English musician Clive Wearing. Explain what happened to him.
Clive was a very gifted musician and musicologist, pioneer in Renaissance music, when in 1985 he had a devastating brain infection, a herpes encephalitis, which especially destroyed some of the memory systems in his brain. So he developed a profound amnesia, so much so that he would lose everything in a few seconds. If you came in the room, he would greet you. 10 seconds later, you'd be a stranger, and he'd greet you again. And along with this, there was a loss of many memories from his past life. A great deal of his autobiography was gone. But his ability to perform music, and even to conduct a choir or an orchestra at a masterly level, was absolutely unchanged.
So he could remember those musical pieces. Somehow those memories came back to him, the musical memories.
Well, let's put it this way. The power of musical performance, the music came back to him. He might, you know, if you showed him a Bach fugue, you know, the printed page, he'd say, never seen it before. But if you just start him on the first note, he would play the whole fugue perfectly and then in some amazement discover that he knew it. So that he possessed a huge memory of which he was unaware. And when he was performing music, improvising at the organ, singing, conducting, he seemed utterly himself and, you know, gifted, charming, full of sensitivity and intelligence. Seconds later, he'd have no memory of this and he'd be confused and disoriented and frightened. And so that there was this day and night difference between the two Clives.
That's neurologist Oliver Sacks talking with Steve Paulson about his book Musicophilia, Tales of Music and the Brain. You just can't listen to Oliver Sacks talking about his patients without a sense of wonder. He seems to find people the rest of us would never know but find fascinating. It's a comfort to know that music is, as he says, so robust that music can apparently survive even a stroke. When you hear someone like this on the radio, you know it's a special place. A place that belongs to you. Help us make a strong future for your public radio station. Here's someone to tell you how. Do you wish you could write or draw but think you can't? Then you need to meet our friend Linda Berry. For 30 years, Linda wrote one of the country's best-known alternative comic strips, Ernie Pook's Comique. She's also the creator of a popular writing workshop called Writing the Unthinkable, a class designed for non-writers. Linda tells Ann Strainchamps how it works.
What happens is I'll say, okay, number a page from 1 to 10, and I want you to think back to early days in your life. And I say, okay, now, if you were going to tell the story of your life just using the word kitchen tables, just write down the first 10 kitchen tables or memories that come to you. And I give people a short amount of time. You have 2 minutes.
All they're doing is listing kitchen tables.
They're listing kitchen tables, yeah. Then I have them go down the list and pick one that seems vivid. Let's go with my Aunt Carol's dinette set. And then I start to ask questions like, where are you, Aunt Carol's kitchen? What time of day or night is it? People are surprised they know. And then I'll say, well, what season is it? And then at this question, a simple question, where's the light coming from right now? And you'll find that the back of your mind has answers to these questions. And it makes you excited because you haven't thought of this stuff in a really long time. And then I have them write for 7.5 minutes, beginning with the words, I am, and writing as if it's happening right now. I am sitting on the ripped Naugahyde chair of my Aunt Carol's dinette set, putting my finger in there. Remember how they'd tear? You put your finger in there and then she'd scream at you.
So full disclosure, I've taken a couple of your workshops, and it's astonishing the way it works. And I think everybody in the room usually has the same feeling of astonishment, like, whoa, where did this come from?
I didn't know
I even remembered that table or that year or that car or whatever.
And that there's often an emotion. The interesting thing about these stories is they'll be little short stories. I mean, they don't even fill a page necessarily if typed up, and they'll have something in them.
You brought in a couple of stories that people have written in your workshops. Can you read one just to give us an example of what sort of thing comes out?
Yeah. Here is a story that was written, and the word that I gave was, I think it was Thanksgiving dinner. So this is a story by Carol Wickersham, and it was written in 7.5 minutes in the workshop, and this is the first draft. I'm sitting at the grown-up table for the first time. Kids at the card table are already eating the rolls. We're waiting for the prayer. We never pray. Our heads are bowed, but we're looking around. Aunt Isel's wig is drooping over her eyes. Next to her, the famous pink Jell-O mold salad with olives that you can wear on your thumbs if you're at the kids' table. We're waiting for Dad to pray. He never prays. What's he going to say? TV, football, first down, 10 yards to go. Now a word from our sponsor. What will I reach for first? And then he reaches over with beery breath. Slap, get your damn hair out of your plate. My braids are yanked back. Tears fall onto my empty plate. I'm wishing I was at the kids' table. My mom squeezes my knee under the table and whispers fiercely, Bill, pray, damn it, so we can eat. He belches and starts. Dear God, in the year ahead and the year behind, may we all perish. Amen. I reach for the rolls, but Aunt Isel beats me, and she plops some of her pink foamy Jell-O on my plate.
I love it.
Oh, pray, damn it, so we can eat.
The thing I love about that is that's 7 minutes. It's such a complete story.
Yeah, it is. It is. And they kind of have this quality. They're very different kinds of stories than one that's been labored over, where you know that every sentence is moving toward this one thing. It's a different kind of writing, but it's vivid to me and really satisfying. And my friend Kelly Hogan, the great singer, describes the class as, she goes, well, the way I explain it is that you blow your mind with your own mind.
So there's all this neuroscience now about brain function and creativity. You started by saying you call this process writing the unthinkable, which suggests it's writing with a different part of the brain, maybe. Do you think that?
Absolutely, I do. I've been really interested in the work of this brilliant guy named Ian McGilchrist. One of the things that he's done is he's written brilliantly about how we kind of have two brains. the left side of the brain, which is the part I'm using right now to speak and use language, likes the parts of things. It likes technology. It likes logic. It likes purpose. It likes utility. It's the parent in you that when you say, I want to be an artist, says, well, then I'm not paying for school. Yeah, hell no. It's that side. No, you're going to do something that you can make a living. So it's all about function and utility. And it's quite an important part of the brain. The other side is where we respond to music, poetry, metaphor, things as a whole, our experience of actual depth and distance. And so the studies that McGilchrist talks about, there are theories that in a weird way, part of the function of the brain is to shut the other side up. You know what I mean? It'd be like Well, either side can shut up.
So are you saying that you think that the writing process you've come up with is this is the right brain doing the writing?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is my little theory, and maybe it could be full of baloney. But the thing I know about the left side of the brain is the left side of the brain also grasps, it's our precision grip, you know, the way we hold a pen. And I believe that writing by hand makes it so the left side of the brain's kind of satisfied. I'm doing something. I'm holding this pen. And so that because it's sort of engaged, I always feel like the right side of the brain can come forward. And I think one of the reasons why this is so pleasurable, it's not just because the experience of writing and remembering is pleasurable. That's true. But it carries out into the world. When you finish doing it, the world looks more alive.
Why is that?
Because we've kind of come alive. The back of the mind has an entirely different relationship, actually, to visual stuff, to depth, and to seeing things as a whole versus seeing things in little parts. And I think that that's part of the function, is that that's a more alive, less worried way to be. I mean, I think we need both sides. But I think what this work does, along with the side effect is you get some good stories, is it does make you feel more whole and more alive. And that's what I think the function of the arts is.
Cartoonist Linda Berry talking with Anne Strainchamps about her popular writing workshop, Writing the Unthinkable. You can read more about her writing technique in her book, What It Is. I found myself smiling after listening to Linda Berry talk about writing. Her enthusiasm bubbles up from inside her somewhere, but she's willing to share it with everybody. You actually begin to think you could be a better writer after listening. That's the kind of thing that makes public radio worth listening to. And worth supporting with a pledge. Here's someone to tell you how.